I'm we talked about the ninth, the first nine steps. We talked about amends, and one of the things that I will encourage everyone here to do is not to charge in to make amends where you're going to harm another person. Please do not make ninth step amends without the guidance of a centered, in recovery, sober sponsor. It is extremely important that you bounce these things off of a person who is in recovery, or you will go in there and cause more harm by making amends. And they say the road to hell is paved with good intentions, and oftentimes what happens is in our zeal to right these matters, we create more harm if we're going in a misguided type of situation. Now, excuse me, there are a lot of people who get the impression that when Bill and Bob first met in Akron, Ohio, that it was June the 10th, 1935, because that is the birthday of our way of life. That is not true. They actually met May 12th, 1935, and it was Mother's Day, and it was the day before Mother's Day on Saturday when Henrietta Seiberling received the phone call from Bill Wilson. He was at the Mayflower Hotel. He had spoken to a Reverend Tunks. Reverend Tunks was an Episcopal minister who put him in touch. He was in the Oxford group, and he put him in touch with Henrietta Seiberling. Seiberling was married to one of the sons, or the son of the Goodyear Rubber Company, and Bill was afraid to approach her because he was in Akron in a proxy fight, and he didn't want the Seiberlings to think that he was just some rum hound. But he did call, and he knew that he needed to work with another alcoholic. And she said to him, Henrietta did, you just come right down here. Here's the bus you take. Immediately after talking to Bill, she called Ann Smith, and Ann told Henrietta Seiberling, Henrietta, Bob brought me a potted plant for Mother's Day, and he's potted underneath the plant, underneath the table. And they said the next day, Sunday, May 12, 1935, Ann and Bob Smith called on Henrietta, and Henrietta greeted them, but what she didn't know was that Ann and Bob had made a deal. Bob said to Ann, I'm going to give this guy from New York 15 minutes, and we are going home. Well, they stayed up there for 5 hours. Mm-hmm. Now, here's the funny part. When they were done and Ann Smith went in there to see how things were going, he said to Ann Smith something profound. He said, pointing to Bill, this is the first man that ever really understood my drinking. Now, the reason that that's funny is Bill Wilson had never said one word about Bob's drinking. Not one word about Bob's drinking. All he did was talk about himself, his drinking, his experiences with drinking, and he told him what Silkworth had schooled him on, and that is he expressed to Bob, who was a doctor, a surgeon, a proctologist, about the nature of the illness, which Bob did not know. And Silkworth changed the way Bill was doing his 12-step work, and he did what we're instructed to do today in Chapter 7, and that is he told Bob of the hopeless nature of the mental twist and the physical allergy. And he expressed it in a way that didn't tell Bob what to do, but he told him about himself. But Bob had one more good drunk left in him. And on the, I believe it's the 6th of June, 1935, I could be wrong on that date, but I don't think so, Bob was going to Atlantic City to a medical convention, and Ann Smith begged Bill not to let Bob go. He said, Bill, you can't let Bob go to this convention. He gets drunk there every damn year. And Bill said to Ann Smith, let him go, Ann. He's living in a world where there's an abundance of alcohol. He's either going to get drunk or he's not. And there's nothing I can do to stop him if he wants to get drunk. Bob goes to the convention. He's drunk before the train pulls out of Akron. He's well supplied. He had been planning this. He gets to Atlantic City. He is plastered. He's there for a few days. He comes home on the 9th of June, and he has a surgery scheduled for the next day, which is the 10th. I'm not quite sure what the procto is, but I'm glad he wasn't operating on mine that day. And he says to Bill that he can't do the surgery. His hand is shaking. He's been drinking. He's been drunk. He ended up at the home of his nurse. His nurse calls Ann Smith and says, well, you better come down here and get him. Guess who's at my house drunk? And she goes over there and gets Bob, brings him back home, and Bill's there. And they sober him up, and they take him to the hospital. And Bill did something for Dr. Bob that morning that a lot of AA sponsees wish their sponsors would do for them. He popped open a beer so that he could steady Bob's hand, and Bob did the surgery. And Bill and Ann Smith, Bill waited in the parking lot for hours. Finally, he goes back to Ardmore Street where the Smiths lived. He pulls in. He says, Ann, I don't know what happened to him. Bill figures, and I guess Ann does too, that the beer has re-triggered the physical allergy and that Bob is off to the races. Hours go by. It's midnight. Here comes Dr. Bob up Ardmore Street, sober as sober can be. One of the tenets of the Oxford group that we read yesterday is restitution. Restitution. Dr. Bob had been going up and down Akron, going to people who he had harmed while drunk to make restitution to those people. He never found it necessary to drink again all the days of his life, and he passed away in 1950 with 15 years of sobriety. That date of Dr. Bob's making of restitution, June 10th, 1935, is considered to be the birth date of our way of life. It is considered Founders Day. It is considered a day that all people everywhere, and we were talking about this at breakfast, about all the various 12-step programs and all the various addictions that we see today. Everything sprang from that meeting, that time on June the 10th, 1935, when Dr. Bob made his restitution. The ninth step is an emancipating situation. I told you yesterday of some of the amends that I made to people who were dead. There were also people who I made amends to that were alive, and I paid them back. And some of the amends that I had were monetary amends, and some of them got by me, and something changed in my life. And it went from being my money to being our money, because some of the stuff surfaced after I was married. And I went to my then wife, who understood and said, pay them back. Because it was no longer just my money, it was our money. So I had to include her in that decision, in that action of paying the money back. Because we had a young child who had a lot of health problems. We were living in Eugene, Oregon at the time. We'll get to a story about that to this morning too, and so on. But the bottom line is that the so-called promises, and I love the promises, but the reason I sort of want to remind you of this is there are so many beautiful promises all through the book that you don't have to wait for page 83. But the promises that we know today come after step 9, between 9 and 10. And we see so much growth in people that have done this step. And where you see people, and if you're sponsoring others or you're being sponsored, just remember that it's never the step that it would appear to stump you. it's usually step two in this regard. You either feel God's hand holding you or you don't. Make those amends. Face the music. You have so much power behind you. You're going to be fine. If you were smart enough to take the money, you should be smart enough to pay it back. And if you owe the house, make that amends. And before we read the so-called promises, the beautiful promises, I don't mean to say so-called, but the beautiful promises, if we can, let's go to the anti-promises on page 52, the bedevilments, because on page 83 we're going to find the promises, but I want to just kind of remind you that on 52 is the anti-promises, and here's what happens if you don't work the program, and those are the bedevilments on 52. Now, what I do with someone that I sponsor, and I know that some of you are secretly grateful that I'm not your sponsor, but what I do is we turn these into questions. It says here on 52, and this is in the chapter We Agnostics, and this is what happens when I don't have a God in my life. We had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply our human problems this same readiness to change our point of view. We were having trouble with our personal relationships. You betcha. So I would ask, were you? And the answer is always yes. Mm-hmm. We couldn't control our emotional natures. Absolutely. We were a prey to misery and depression. You bet. We couldn't make a living. I couldn't. I couldn't hold money. I couldn't earn money. I was a failure. We had a feeling of uselessness. Absolutely. I was waiting for somebody to come and take care of me. We were full of fear. You betcha. We were unhappy. You betcha. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. As much as I tried to help them, I wasn't even able to save myself. And on the airplane that I came on, they had a great Al-Anon meeting. They said, put your mask on first and then help the people you're with. There's a great Al-Anon meeting on every airplane. And if you get on a boat, you ever take a cruise, there's a great Al-Anon meeting there. They say, put your life preserver on first, then help the people around you. And if you ever took a life-saving class from the Red Cross, they never tell you, go in after the person. They say, tow, throw, go. You try to keep yourself safe, and then you help the other person. You must have something so that you can give it away. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Was not a basic solution of these bedevilments more important than whether we should see newsreels of lunar flight? Of course it was. Now let's go to page 83. Here's what happens if you do work the program. Here's what happens if you do make amends. Here's what happens if you do live this way of life. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, I want to back up one paragraph before we do this. Two paragraphs. The spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. Live it is an action word. Unless one's family expresses a desire to live upon spiritual principles, we think we ought not urge them. We should not talk incessantly to them about spiritual matters. They will change in time. Our behavior will convince them more than our words. We must remember that 10 or 20 years of drunkenness would make a skeptic out of anyone. There may be some wrongs we can never fully right. We don't worry about them if we can honestly say to ourselves that we would right them if we could. Some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter. And there may be a valid reason for postponement in some cases, but we don't delay it if it can be avoided. We should be sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble without being servile or scraping. As God's people, we stand on our feet. We don't crawl before anyone. Have dignity. This way of life gives me dignity. I was wrong. I was a jerk then, but I'm not going to crawl before any man. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we think about them. No, if we work for them. This is not a program for people who need it. It is not a program for people who want it. This is a program for people who do it, who take that action. This thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. We vigorously commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past. We have entered the world of the Spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for our lifetime. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the misconceptions about step 10 is that it gets done in the morning and or at night. That's 11. Step 10 is a constant step. I am working steps all day. No matter how evolved my recovery gets, I will never rise above the level of a human being. And as a human being, I have human concerns. It's getaway day in most retreats for me, but not this time. I'm going to be here until tomorrow very late. So where am I going to sleep tonight? What's that going to be like? What am I going to have for dinner? Am I going to get my boarding pass printed? Is it going to be okay on the plane? I better not forget my jacket. I better not forget to pack my new book. I better make sure I squish everything in that dang little suitcase I brought because I only have a carry-on. I better make sure I take this, and I better make sure I don't forget that. And all these little crazy chatterings go on in my mind, and I remember, wait a minute, this is fear. This is just fear. It's really going to be okay. If there was anything wrong with my German Shepherd, they would have called me. They would have texted me. Let's see. The business, I already planned on taking tomorrow off. God's got my back. I keep remembering that my real purpose is to be of maximum service to God and the people about me. I'm supposed to be here with you. Otherwise, I wouldn't be. I'm supposed to be doing this morning. Otherwise, God would have put someone else up here. And as long as I'm serving God, I'm okay. But I still have that chatter in my mind. So, what do? I continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. What is this? This is fear that I have going on here. What's going to happen is Janice going to just dump me in the ocean and say, see you, fatso, and leave me there, and I'll get eaten by a whale or something? You know, not going to happen. When these crop up, not if these crop up, when these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. Now I'm going to give you a little spit and polish, but you can't tell anybody. Are you ready? You're not going to tell, right? Assume God has done so. Assume that when you ask God to remove the fear, the selfishness, the self-seeking, or the anger, the dishonesty, that He has done so. Don't wait for the Hancock Building to fall on you. Now, what am I supposed to... Don't wait for the hand. Oh.
It wasn't specific. I didn't assume. No, the assume sentence.
Okay. Assume that the God of your understanding has done so. Don't start thinking about the fear from another direction and pick it back up again and pick it back up again. Okay. Now, continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up, and it could be that I make 17 10-step calls throughout the day. It could be that I make 12. It could be that I make 9. It could be that I make 400 of them. In the aftermath of being told I want a divorce, things got a little crazy in my head. Okay? This is the only family I ever knew. And it's dissolving in front of me. And what's going to happen to me now, kind of thing. You know what? I'm okay. We're 2 years out. I'm okay. And I'm ready for what God has for me to do next. Who knows? I might end up living with Randy in the place where there's like 100 people or something. You never know. But I'm ready to go. We have apartment buildings with more people than that. But anyway, I kid. Okay, I kid because I love her.
I joke.
And no honey pot. Honey pots to me is the Winnie the Pooh thing. No, I'm sure. But you got to remember, I raised a little girl, and Winnie the Pooh was like an everyday thing. Okay,
Let's say you're at work and you're getting and you have a moment you can call. Can you just...
There's a cathedral in every office building. It's called restroom. I often would go in there when I was working for other companies. Now I own the place, and I work from home. But it's called the restroom. And if you think I won't go in there and pray, you're crazy. If you think I won't go in there and lock the door behind me and say, God, I need you to remove the fear. Let's go back to the chatter about...
You can then do it yourself. I don't have to call someone.
I absolutely will call someone, especially with a cell phone. You better believe I'm going to do what it takes, and then I'm going to do the rest. You better believe it. And if I get fired for making a 10-step call, I wasn't supposed to have that job in the first place. If I can't make a 10-step call from the bathroom, then that's not a place I should probably be working. I will make up the work. I will do what is in front of me. I will establish myself as a worker that can be counted on, and I always did. I always got my sales end. I always met quotas. So nobody was going to say anything to me about going in there. And if it sounded a little odd to someone coming in there, if I'm on the phone, eventually they got to know me that I am a little whacked out and I am a little crazy and that these things are going to happen. But they will also find out through the grapevine that I used to weigh as much as any four of them, or that, you know, there were times when I weighed, you know, God knows what. So you bet your life, I'm going to put my recovery before anything. Anything I put in front of that recovery, like fear about my job, if I'm living in that kind of fear, then I need to say, God, remove my fear. When these crop up, it's cropping up, I have a fear about losing my job. We ask God at once to remove them. Assume he has done so. Assume he has done so. Don't wait for the Hancock Building to fall on you. We discuss them with somebody immediately. It doesn't say discuss it with somebody at lunchtime or, you know, after, whatever. Discuss it with somebody immediately, okay? And make amends quickly if we've harmed anybody. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Resolutely means with purpose, with great purpose, with great energy. Get out of Harlan is the key. I cannot stay well if I stay in self. What did Bill teach us from the beginning of the book to the end of the book? He found that when all other measures failed, work with another alcoholic would save the day. He gives us this message, and the book gives us this message. God gives us the message, not really Bill. Constantly, my real purpose is to be of maximum service to God and the people about me. Bill found that when all other measures failed, work with another alcoholic would save the day. Dr. Silkworth calls it an altruistic movement. All through the chapters of the book, we are told, get out of you, get out of you. No problem I've ever had could gain in perspective to the point of triggering my strange mental twist, driving me into the food when I did this step. Because if I don't do the step and I am harboring, remember that word that we used in chapter 5 when harboring such feelings? Harboring means to give safe haven to them. I'm going to give safe haven to the fear about losing my job. I better not go in there and do a 10-step. I'm going to harbor that fear. I have shut myself off from the sunlight of the Spirit. Now I'm operating on self-will. Once I'm operating on self-will, I am not in recovery, I am on a
diet.
Once I'm on a diet, I'm now going to have all these emotions cropping to the surface, and I'm going to trigger that strange mental twist. The mental twist is going to irresistibly scream out to the brain, get some Oreos, get some Oreos. She's a witch, get some Oreos, get some Oreos. He's a jerk, get some Oreos. Okay, okay, but this time I'm only going to have three. Yeah, 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 only three. Yeah, go, go, go. Yeah, 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 only three this time. Yeah, yeah, right, right, right. So I eat the three Oreos, and now I've eaten 300 Oreos. I will pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful, with a firm resolution not to eat Oreos again, and I will repeat that cycle over and over and over again, the mind telling me it's okay to eat the Oreos, the body ensuring that it's not okay to eat Oreos. So this is how we die of the illness. We do not die of the illness because of some unknown thing. This is the mechanics of the illness. This is the nuts and the bolts. So what we're going to do again, and I said this Friday, I said this yesterday, what we are doing when we talk about God, and there are going to be people coming in your meetings that are going to talk about, why do we talk about God? I want us to, that are here, to understand that this is a prime example. You have a feeling of fear. Okay, I have a feeling of, how am I going to get out of here? Are they going to cancel my flight? How am I going to get the boarding pass? You know, the old shitty committee in my head. Okay, I'm going to ask God to remove the fear. I'm going to assume He has done so. I'm going to discuss it with you. I'm discussing it with everybody here, okay? Then I'm going to make amends quickly if I've harmed anybody. In this case, I haven't really harmed anybody. Okay, then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help, and I'm going to do this, but I'm also going to make outreach calls. I'm going to a hotel today, or a motel or something, I don't know. When I get back, my pocket here has been like doing the twist here for like a while, because I got people. I will return every one of those phone calls. I will make sure that I get out of myself today, okay? Why do we need God, and what is the purpose of the steps as it breaks down into this mechanic? You have the mental twist. This is the mental twist that drives me into the food. There is a clear, unabated path between the mental twist and the physical allergy. The mental twist has me picking up the food against my will. I don't want to be eating this turkey out of the refrigerator. I don't want to be going in there for the stuffing when everybody's asleep. I don't want to be eating all this pie, all these cookies. I'm going to get found out. I'll screw it. I'll just go in the morning, buy another one, put it in there. They'll never know the difference. And there may be even more stuff in the cupboard. I'll take a look in a second. That is the action of the allergy. So here is what we're going to do very graphically. And I'll have to get my rear end up for this one. Here is the mental twist. Here is the physical allergy. What we're going to do is, this little big book here is going to be God. Right in between. The mental twist gets evaded by God. The mental twist gets short-circuited by the actions of the steps. So those feelings cannot build to the level where the scream of the food in my head becomes irresistible. You didn't want to be eating the food you were eating. You knew better intellectually. When I was about 10 years old, I was a Friday afternoon. Now, my mother didn't drive, which is probably good. Probably a good thing for the people of Chicago. Okay, my mother did not drive a car. But it was a Friday afternoon, and my mother always got a live chicken delivered after it was slaughtered, and she'd pick the feathers out. And sometimes I'd do it, too. It was fun. And there's gizzards in there, and there's eggs in there, and I don't even know why I'm talking about the chicken, because it's not really part of the story. But, okay, so, I decided that I was going to make a salami sandwich, and my dad's butcher knife was on the table, and there's a stone that he would use to sharpen the knife, and he would butcher the chicken when he got home real quick, and he really knew what he was doing. Well, I decided I was going to be like my dad, and I used his knife to make a salami sandwich. I have a scar in my finger to this day where I cut my finger on that really hard salami. Salami in my house wasn't something that came sliced in a package. It hung from a nail, and it would dry out, and we'd have several of them at various stages of hardness, and I like them like a piece of concrete. And I cut into my finger. Now, my mother couldn't drive, but she could scream. Oh, she could scream. And she started screaming, and the neighbors were like, "What's going on? Virginia, what's, are you getting killed in there?" You know, we lived in a real tight neighborhood. So I cut my finger, and I have a scar, and I got to tell you something. You know, that occurred 48 years ago. And to this day, particularly now, I'm on Pradaxa, which is a blood thinner. So if I cut myself, it bleeds till like probably next Wednesday or Thursday. So anyway, I'm really careful when I handle a knife. Mm-hmm. Food has ransacked me, maimed me, deformed me, amputated me, embarrassed me, humiliated me, dragged me through pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization to the point where if I would have taken that knife and plunged it into my throat, it could not have done the damage to my life that the food did. And yet, because of a mental twist and a physical allergy, if I stop working the steps, I will eat the food yet again, fully convinced that this time it will not kill me. That is a sickness. That is an illness. God is the only force that can get in between the mental twist to eat the food, which will come up as I start monkey chattering in my head about, oh, I better get the boarding pass printed, and oh my God, what am I going to do if they cancel my flight? And oh my God, what's going to happen to Emma? Emma's my German Shepherd. And oh my God, what's going to happen? So I'm going to eat the food because that's it's only going to take a short period of time before that will drive me into the food. I'm going to trigger the physical allergy, which is going to make it impossible. I'm going to repeat this again. If you're tired of hearing it, get tired of living in it. Those emotions of fear, selfishness, self-seeking, and anger, resentment, will burst to the surface in me. Why? I'm a human being. No matter how evolved my recovery gets, I will never rise above the level of a human being. And as a human being, I've got a month left at the end of my money. The girl I have a crush on is not hearing about it, not wanting to go out with me. The whatever it is, whatever that situation is, fear will come up when I sense I may not get my way in the future. Resentment will come up, to do again. Sentiments from sentire, the Latin to feel, when I re-feel old hurts, old injuries, and as I do, I will change them just a bit and make your part more dastardly, my part more innocent, until I was standing there doing nothing. Just nothing. And Paula came along and did me dirt. And based on Paula doing me the damn dirt, I will eat the food, trigger the allergy, pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to eat this way again. And I will repeat that cycle over and over and over again, the mind telling me it's okay and the body ensuring that it's not. I don't play with knives, but I'll play with food. Because I don't have a mental twist that said, oh, juggle the knives. Come on. This time you won't get cut. Come on. Pradaxa. So you'll bleed a little. Who doesn't? Come on. Pradaxa also makes you sick to your stomach. Yes.
I have a question.
Sure.
Do you believe in making amends to yourself? Because a lot of us have done. a whole lot of stuff to ourselves.
There are three things. There are three things that I do to make amends to little Harlan. I recover. Those are the three things I do to little Harlan that I did so much to. It's not even funny. And I loved him, but he couldn't close his little league uniform, and he didn't get to go to the prom, and he didn't get to go to homecoming, and he never got to hold a girl's hand, and he never made out in the back seat of a car, and he never went to the movies with a girl, and all this other stuff. And I make amends to him, recover. And I just don't know a better way to do it. I really don't.
So no special writing, no anything of that sort.
If you feel you want to do special writing, go do special writing. It's not part of the step. But if you feel that that's going to make you feel better about you and make them, then go for it. There's no reason not to. I mean, but...
But to your sponsor, you just tell recover.
Recover, recover, and recover. I tell them three things. Okay, yes.
What about amends to God?
I make amends to God three ways. Okay, I make amends to God in recover, recover, and recover, and I open myself to service. When the committee for the OA birthday calls, if they call, I'm there. If Paula call. And by the way, if I said anything this weekend that you really don't like, blame Paula. She's the one that asked me to come. If you... She's the one. She is the one that, you know, Paula Kay was the one that asked me to come here. So, okay. So if I'd said anything bad, right over there. Brown shirt. All right. Anyway. All right. And we have ceased fighting. Oh, love and tolerance of others is our code. And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol, for by this time sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as if from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we will find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we had been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. This is our experience. This is how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. It is easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. We are headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. We are not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities, not some, all. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. Again, the first thing we're asking God is, how can I serve you? I am here to serve. I am here to get out of myself. These are thoughts which must go with us constantly. So that prayer, God, how can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. I say that prayer 150 times a day. When I see something or I hear something, I remember there is a God and it's not me. Because like most human beings, sometimes I see something or I'll hear something and I think I know better and I want to kind of interject that Harlan opinion. You know what? Harlan's opinion is based on just very limited knowledge. I can't see past the end of my flipping nose. God sees things. He knows things around corners and underwater and over land and over sea. I can't know what He knows. You know, some of us in this room have suffered deaths of loved ones, and some of us in this room have suffered divorces, and some of us in this room have had our hearts broken. Dare I say, there's probably not a person in this room that hasn't been in those situations. My God. You know, and then there was a day when we laughed, and then there was a day where we had fun, and there was a day when the world looked different. That's nothing I can bring about on my own. That's nothing I can bring about sitting here sick in self. That's nothing I can enjoy, because I can't unless I'm going to work for God. When I start getting out of myself, when I start really reaching for that other person, and we'll talk about this in step 12, I'm seeing the face of God in the mirror. I'm seeing the face of God in my fellow human being. I'm seeing the face of God. When I'm in the food, I can't see any of this. Who cares? Mount McKinley, and we were talking at breakfast about the beautiful bay and how you had fallen in love with the bay as almost as if it was a crush on a boy. And some of you have just the way you speak about your home here. It's poetry. It's beautiful. I can't hear any of that in the food. I don't care. But I can listen to you and I can see the passion that you have for your Alaska. I don't know that I've ever been in a place, and I've been a lot of places to do these retreats. I have been to most states in this union. I've never come up with a group or never come up, never encountered, that's the word I'm really looking for, encountered, not come up. I've never encountered a group that was as passionately in love with their home as you Alaskans. Never. Never. People just don't talk like that. It's poetry. It's music. I can't hear any of that. Who cares? Where's the whipped cream? That's really nice, honey, but could you either get out of the way, or could I have some of those raisinettes you seem to be eating or not eating or something, or are you going to finish those? That's what I really want to know. That's a blessing for me that I can take back with me that memory of a group of people that love so passionately where they live. Somebody said to me today, I saw the bay and it was like I had a crush on a boy. I've never heard anybody talk about their home like that in my life. Never. Never heard it. What a beautiful thing for them to feel. And what a beautiful thing to share with somebody. And the miracle is I'm able to take it in. And not think, are you going to finish those? And that's just really a miracle. That's really a miracle. And if you're not seeing that miracle, stick around. Mm-hmm. It'll have more meaning. It really will. Help. Oh, much thanks has been, thank you, has been said about receiving strength, inspiration, and direction from Him who has all knowledge and power. If we have carefully followed directions, not suggestions, directions, we have begun to sense the flow of His Spirit into us. To some extent, we have become God-conscious. We have begun to develop this vital sixth sense. But we must go further, and that means more action. More thinking? No, more action. Step 11 suggests prayer and meditation. We shouldn't be shy on this matter of prayer. Better men than we are using it constantly. It works if we have the proper attitude and work at it. It would be easy to be vague about this matter, yet we believe we can make some definite and valuable suggestions. When we retire at night, now the reason that the nighttime section of 11 is listed first is it is assumed you have been doing 10 steps all day. And when we get to one of these paragraphs here, you're going to ask God all through the day to show you what the next step is to be. That's on the next page. But the bottom line is, it is assumed you've been doing 10 steps all day long. When we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? What other step did we use to work on resentment, selfishness, dishonesty, and fear? Step 4, correct. Do we owe an apology? What step did we use to make apologies?
9.
Correct. Have we kept something to ourselves which should be discussed with another person at once? What step did we use to discuss something with another person?
5.
Were we kind and loving toward all? What could we have done better? There's that question from the sex inventory of the fourth step. Here's that question again. What could we have done better? Were we thinking of ourselves most of the time? Were we thinking of what we could do for others, of what we could pack into the stream of life? But we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. After making our review, we ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures should be taken. And that's going to be requiring you to have a sponsor that's clean and knowledgeable. Now, one of the things that's touched on again in that paragraph is, what can I pack in to stream of life? All of my life, I was an unhappy taker because there was never enough for me to take. And when I went into a situation, like we were talking at breakfast about going to a wedding, or if I'm going to a party or a bar mitzvah or whatever that might be for me where I'm going, I'm going to be very, very fearful because I'm not going to get enough. I'm going to be worried about who's going to say what to me about my weight, my shape, my size, my eating, what I'm not eating, what diets they think I should go on, whatever. One of the things that has happened to me in my life is that I have been reborn. And rather than go into these situations, like coming here to Anchorage, Alaska, to see what I could get out of it, I am looking to pack in. I'm looking to give. And let me let you in on a secret. Nobody is getting more out of this weekend than me. I am getting so much from all of you that I can't fit it into my carry-all and I can't fit it into my heart, because I have gotten such wonderment, such love from all of you here that I cannot even contain it. So if I'm coming here to see what you can give me, I'll be very disappointed. I won't be happy. When I come into any given situation to give rather than take, that's when true happiness takes place in my heart. So as more, again, from the beginning of the book to the end, Bill found, work with another alcoholic, when all other measures failed, work with another alcoholic would save the day. Get out of you, get out of you. On awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day. Before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking, especially that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. Under these conditions, we can employ our mental faculties with assurance, for after all, God gave us brains to use. Our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. And then it says, in thinking about our day, we may face indecisions. And this confusion will often drive me into the food, because if I can't make a decision, and I won't make a decision, I get to that point where I'm going to trigger that mental twist. And whenever I have to question, is this God's decision or is it my decision, here is how I base it. God's will is soft and consistent. It's just there. God speaks to me very softly. My ego is a screamer right now. We got to have it right now. Right now. And the ego is insistent. God is consistent. I hear him say to me, shh, quiet. Be still, for I'm God. Just choose that brand of whatever. Just choose that place to go. Just choose that thing. And I don't have that committee going in my head. The itty-bitty shitty committee in my head does not have to hold board meetings when it's God's decision. Paula contacted me about coming here, and at first I was scared. You can't get a nonstop. Oh, there's a nonstop. I can't get home that Sunday. It's not going according to my script. Oh, okay, I'll stay another day, whatever. So it just felt right to say yes, so here I am. It just felt right. God's decisions just feel right. So much energy. My God, when I was a kid, Miss Summerhill, in third grade, she showed a film strip. That's how old I am, a film strip. And it said that the human heart will do enough work in the first 60 years of life to raise a battleship 3 feet out of the water. My disease in the first 10 minutes of life will raise enough energy to throw the battleship over the John Hancock building and play volleyball with it. I can relax and I can take it easy and I'm not going to light a match to the energy and the years of my life and the decades of my life where it was constant, constant insanity, constant resentment, fear, resentment, fear, resentment, fear, and driving me. Let me just finish a little bit and I'll come back to it. Okay. In thinking about our day, we may face indecision. We may not be able to determine which course to take. Here we ask God for inspiration, an intuitive thought, or a decision. We relax and take it easy. We don't struggle. We are often surprised how the right answers come after we have tried this for a while. What used to be the hunch or the occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. Being still inexperienced and having just made conscious contact with God, it is not probable that we are going to be inspired at all times. We might pay for this presumption in all sorts of absurd actions and ideas. Nevertheless, we find that our thinking will, as time passes, be more and more on the plane of inspiration we come to rely on it. We usually conclude the period of meditation with a prayer that we be shown all through the day what our next step is to be, that we be given whatever we need to take care of such problems. We ask especially for freedom from self-will and are careful to make no requests for ourselves only. We may ask for ourselves, however, if others will be helped. We are careful never to pray for our own selfish ends. Many of us have wasted a lot of time doing that, and it doesn't work. You can easily see why. You go back to page 13 in Bill's story, you see the identical language. Let's just go back here and take a look for 1 second, and then I'll get to you. Let's just go back to page 13. Now, listen again in your mind to the paragraph that we just read, and here's 13. My schoolmate visited me. I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies. We made a list of people I had hurt or toward whom I felt resentment. Hold on. All right, sorry about that. I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness within. Common sense would thus become uncommon sense. I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking for only for direction and strength to meet my problems as he would have me. Never was I to pray for myself except as my request bore on my usefulness to others. Then only might I expect to receive, but that would be in great measure. It's the same exact thing, and that's what he's doing in the town's hospital. He's working this, what we know as our 11th step, and you see that the language is exactly the same. It doesn't change. It's the same idea. Seek to give rather than get. All right, let me just finish a little bit and I'll get let me just finish this and I'll get to you. If circumstances warrant, we ask our wives or friends to join us in morning meditation. If we belong to a religious denomination which requires a definite morning devotion, we attend to that also. If not members of religious bodies, we sometimes select and memorize a few set prayers which emphasize the principles we have been discussing. There are many helpful books also. Suggestions about these may be obtained from one's priest, minister, or rabbi. Be quick to see where religious people are right. Make use of what they offer. As we go through the day, we pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. We constantly remind ourselves we are no longer running the show. Humbly saying to ourselves many times each day, "Thy will be done." We are then in much less danger of excitement, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, or foolish decisions. We become much more efficient. We do not tire so easily, for we are not burning up energy foolishly as we did when we were trying to arrange life to suit ourselves. It works. It really does. We alcoholics are undisciplined, so we let God discipline us in a way we have just outlined. But this is not all. There is action and more action. Faith without works is dead. This is the third time I think we've seen it, or fourth time. The next chapter is entirely devoted to step 12. Now, by the way, what was your...
Oh, they're talking about the relaxing about God's will is soft and consistent. My will is insistent. I had heard the expression, we've all heard, don't just sit there, do something. But in Al-Anon, they say, don't just do something, sit there. And I found that very helpful.
Yes, it is very helpful. It is very, very